I'm Robin Young. Welcome to Here and Now. Scientists are testing samples of 20 tar balls found washed ashore in the Florida Keys last night to see if they came from the BP oil blowout in the Gulf of Mexico. Meanwhile, where is the oil slick? Do the tar balls mean the slick is not far behind? Jeff Lennox is a reporter for NBC affiliate WESH in Orlando, Florida. Jeff, first remind us, what's a tar ball?
Yeah, that's a big question everyone's been asking over the last couple of hours. And after talking to the Coast Guard and looking online, found out that a tar ball, what it is basically, it's when oil has been weathered over a long period of time. It basically forms into these blobs of oil, very dark blobs of oil, and that's what we're dealing with. They usually run anywhere from about 3 to 10 inches in diameter. We were talking to the Coast Guard earlier today, and they say in terms of cleanup, actually these tar balls are easier to work with because the oil has congealed together. So it's a lot easier to basically, you know, scoop them out of the water. You know, they can pose a threat if they do wash on shore because, you know, it's sort of like a thick mass that can sort of spread out once it hits shore and possibly jeopardize some wildlife out in the water as well.
And we understand they were found on the shore of Fort Zachary Taylor State Park in Key West. Some people know where that is. And those of us who, you know, go to the beach a lot know that tar balls do tend to wash up on the beach. But if these are from the BP oil spill, does that necessarily mean that the slick is right behind them? We know that University of South Florida professors were saying that this slick was in danger of getting into the loop current. This is the current that would pull it around the Keys and up the Atlantic coast. Do these tar balls mean the slick is not far behind?
Well, if you're talking about that slick, and again, this is coming from the U.S. Coast Guard. We talked to them earlier today down here in Central Florida. And, you know, the slick, while it may start to enter the loop current up toward, you know, the panhandle, toward Tampa and those areas, you know, as it does continue to move through the water, it does go through that weathering process. So in time, it will form these tar balls. So the likelihood that the slick will make its way on down to South Florida and around eventually to the eastern coast of Florida and the Central Florida coast where we're located, it's not likely. It could happen potentially, but at this point, they believe if it does come up this way, to the eastern coast of Florida, will likely be in that tar ball form or those oil blobs that they're picking up right now in South Florida off Key West.
Well, and we know there's disagreement about this because you've got the University of South Florida saying that the oil is already in the loop current, and you've got officials at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration disagreeing.
There is. There's a lot of controversy right now as to whether these blobs are actually from the spill itself. I know that NASA came out with some images earlier today. They were pretty telling. Those are online right now that basically show that it looks as if possibly something is moving through the loop current right now. And a lot of scientists, too, and some people we talk with the Coast Guard want us to take caution here because it is a big shipping channel in South Florida with, you know, freighters that go through and your larger cruise ships. You know, they can expel some of this oil and tar balls form from those vessels as they move through. So this could be a case of, you know, tar balls coming off those ships. So, you know, again, we have to take all this and err on the side of caution and wait for these final reports come out.
Well, meanwhile, the Obama administration has been excoriating oil officials for finger-pointing. They're considering a presidential panel to investigate what's happened. It would be similar to the investigation of the Challenger disaster. There was a devastating report on 60 Minutes on Sunday about that fight between BP and Halliburton and Transocean officials just before the explosion. And government officials are testifying today. They include Interior Secretary Ken Salazar saying the government failed to hold the oil industry accountable. So with all this going on, what is BP doing to assuage some of this anger?
Well, they're doing a lot. I can tell you that yesterday our governor, Charlie Crist, had a closed-door meeting with some BP execs, including the company's CEO. And the governor right now asking for money. He wants money from BP to put some advertisements out there to show and prove, at least at this point, Florida beaches and Florida tourism is largely unaffected by this spill, by the slick that's happening in the Gulf right now. Again, you know, I'm sure the governor had more pointed questions for BP, and we put in several calls to the governor's office. But at this point, we do know right now $25 million is being put to Florida from BP toward advertisements. He wanted $35 million, so we fell about $10 million short of that first offer that he wanted. And I know, you know, of course, other Gulf states are receiving money as well to put ads toward this whole situation, too.
Jeff Lennox of the NBC affiliate WESH in Orlando, Florida, keeping an eye on the coast there. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, in a moment, we're going to take a look at college financial aid. But first, a cautionary tale when filling out those applications. 23-year-old Adam Wheeler's story reads as if it were ripped from the film The Talent of Mr. Ripley. But unlike that fictional character, Adam was arraigned in a Massachusetts court today, charged with stealing over $45,000 in grants and financial aid from Harvard University by lying and fabricating documents to get into the school, and then continuing to fabricate and plagiarize to apply for a Rhodes and a Fulbright scholarship. The Boston Globe's higher education reporter Tracy Jan is following the story. And Tracy, it is amazing. He allegedly managed to send in falsified perfect SAT scores. He claimed to have co-authored books. He faked recommendations on real letterheads. How did he do this?
I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable. Our sources tell us that he paid great attention to the very small details, including even having official envelopes sent in where his transcripts and SAT scores were mailed to Harvard. I have no idea how he did it. I'm sure that will unfold.
Tell us some of the other things that Adam Wheeler is accused of doing.
Well, I mean, he entered Harvard in 2007 as a transfer student, and he won these prestigious writing prizes that Harvard gives to undergraduates. They were plagiarized. One of them was plagiarized from a Cornell University graduate student. When he was applying for the Fulbright and Rhodes scholarships, one of his projects, his works that he submitted, was plagiarized from one of the professors at Harvard, Stephen Greenblatt, who is pretty world-renowned for his work.
Well, someone picked up on that in October and sort of blew the whistle on him. They wanted him to leave the school. He said he was leaving. But then the most incredible thing is that he applied to work at McLean's, a psychiatric hospital here in the Boston area. He also proceeded to apply to Yale and Brown, still using fake references. Well, you know, now he has serious charges, larceny among them, for, you know, stealing the grant and financial aid money. But one professor tells you he thinks that maybe this isn't criminal, but pathological. What are people saying?
Right. Well, this professor knows Adam, obviously, and the professor was just shocked by what happened. I mean, I think everyone was fooled by him. The professor said Adam was a very personable guy, wasn't, you know, super popular, but got along really well with his roommates and thinks that he needs treatment of some sort.
Yeah. We now know that he was a student at Bowdoin College up in Maine until he was dismissed from Bowdoin for what they called academic dishonesty. Do we know what that was?
I don't know what he actually did to be suspended for academic dishonesty. What we do know is that he was required to get out for a semester, and when Bowdoin contacted him in the fall of 2008 to see if he wanted to come back to college, he basically wrote them this letter, and it said, "I am conducting independent research before finishing my degree. I've discussed the options and believe this to be the most amenable to my integrity. Thank you for your consideration of my resignation." Now, at that time, he was actually in his second year at Harvard.
An incredible story. And again, Tracy, you know, what are readers saying? What are people saying? Because on the one hand, this could be a character who celebrated. Look what he did. Look what he pulled on Harvard. On the other hand, there are a lot of young people who really would have liked that slot at Harvard and deserved it.
I mean, I think people are surprised. A lot of people are outraged how this could even happen. And people are just wondering how this could have possibly slipped through the cracks.
Yeah. Tracy Jan of the Boston Globe, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, if you're legitimately looking for college aid, it's out there, and it's a good thing. The College Board reports that for the next school year, the cost of college will climb 5% at private schools and 6.5% at public schools. We spoke to some students here in Boston about the rising costs.
Probably going to have to take out more loans, but hopefully they'll give out more scholarship, but I think it's definitely going to be more costly in the end.
My parents and I have actually talked a lot about this because, you know, we're middle-income family, don't have a whole lot of money to pour into my education, so I've actually sent a letter to my congressman talking about what can be done in order to lower tuition costs.
Students Kate Palachko and Nathan Shen. Well, we want to spend a few minutes on college aid, and we want to start with Kathy Simoneau, the director of financial aid at Loyola University in New Orleans. Kathy, is financial aid going up or down at Loyola?
Financial aid is kind of staying constant. We have been blessed in the couple of years after Katrina with a lot of special money flowing in. That is ending now, 5 years after the storm. But we're having some additional fundraising going on, and so we're working on increasing our institutional aid that we give out to our students.
Well, and Loyola, I would think, is in a special circumstance, buffeted by both the financial crisis and Hurricane Katrina. We're wondering, we were reading in USA Today that because of the financial crisis, a lot of schools were making cuts everywhere except financial aid because they were afraid, you know, if they lost enrollment, then that would be a hit they couldn't take. So
correct.
You had that thinking as well, but how long can schools do that? You know, this is a pretty big crisis.
It is, and we keep on working to try to meet it. It is an art and a science combined, and we work very hard to make sure we're accessible as a Jesuit institution. We have a commitment to first-generation students to be here.
First-generation, those are the first in their family to go to school?
To come to college, mm-hmm. Yeah. And we know those families have specific financial challenges, but we also are aware of our middle-class families having challenges to come up with the finances to come here.
Well, let me ask you about that, because USA Today also points out that some colleges take advantage of the economic crisis as a license to spend more on students who have less need, because they know with those students, if they gave them a little bit of financial aid, they'll get more money from them. And schools need this bottom line. Is that something that you've debated?
At a Jesuit school, we debate everything. But yes, we do need some students here who can pay more, but we are in competition with other universities, and so we have to make it affordable for families to come here.
Well, as part of the healthcare overhaul legislation, lawmakers included a change in the way federally backed student loans are given out. In the past, the federal government handled some loans directly, but private banks handled the bulk of them. They were sort of the middlemen. Now the new law cuts the private banks and the fees that they received out, so the thinking being that there's more money for the loans themselves without the middleman. How are you seeing that play out?
Well, we have been using the private loan program for the past couple of years because the banks, to compete with the direct loan program, started offering better borrower benefits to the families. And since most of our students who are on aid are borrowing, we wanted to use the program that gave them the best deal. So we will be switching back to the direct loan program this summer, and we are cautiously optimistic that we can pull that off and get the money here in August for our students. But it is a big switch. The savings for switching to the direct loan program will be going to increase the number of Pell Grants that are eligible.
And the Pell Grants are for lower-income students.
Correct.
Well, now let's underscore this. So what we're saying is that the federal government is going to take over this huge loan operation, which had been handled by private banks, and you expect it to go well. But still, what would you advise students?
Well, what we're encouraging our students to do is we would really, really, really like them to apply early. The government's electronic processing of the FAFSA, the free application for federal aid, federal student aid, has gotten so good in recent years that a lot of students wait until August to file their FAFSA and have been able to get everything done for school starting at the end of August. We're trying to get our students to apply now and get the loan paperwork done now and beat the back-to-school rush, because that is our concern.
That's Kathy Simoneau, Director of Financial Aid at Loyola University in New Orleans. Kathy, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, up next, what's happening nationally? We'll check in with the editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education. That's in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about the rising cost of college. Before the break, we heard from Kathy Simoneau at Loyola. She said her school is trying to make sure as tuition rises, financial aid does as well. Jeff Salingo is editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education. So, Jeff, does Kathy's experience sound typical?
Yes. I mean, what you've seen is a large increase in financial aid, particularly to freshman students over the last 2 years, because the economy is still tough and schools need to get students in seats. The best way to do that is to offer financial aid.
Exactly. They're afraid of their enrollment dipping and then they're in real trouble. But we understand that there's been a hiccup in another trend that started a couple of years ago. Both Dartmouth and Williams, which said that they would give aid packages to students of any income, are saying they're no longer going to do that.
Yes, and that's because in the good old days when their endowments were going up by double-digit percentage increases every year, they had a lot of extra money to make promises like that. And what was happening was that, you know, Harvard and Yale and Princeton and a lot of the very wealthy, very prestigious institutions were doing it, and all these other institutions had to copy them in order to compete. Well, places like Dartmouth and Williams took big hits to their endowments, which weren't as big as Harvard and Yale to begin with. And as a result, they have to start pulling back on these programs and putting money really where it's needed. And that's to get the neediest students and the most talented students in the door. And then everybody else is kind of waiting by the side.
Well, and that's tough on middle-income families. Yes, they may not be as needy as low-income families, but if you suddenly go from an aid package to a huge tuition, you know, middle-income families can't cover that.
They're the ones being squeezed the most. I had a president of a very prestigious university in my office, and I asked him, how often do you get complaints from parents about tuition costs and or financial aid packages? And he actually said not that often, but the last couple of years he's been getting more, and all of them are coming from middle-income students.
Yeah.
The wealthiest students could afford to pay tuition, and the poorest students are getting financial aid either from the government or from the institution. So it's really the middle-income students are having the most difficult problem paying for college.
Any sense that the structure is going to be changed so students aren't paying so much interest on these loans?
No, and compared to a lot of other consumer loans, interest on student loans is fairly low. The biggest problem is that students have to take so much loan money out in the beginning that over time it really does hinder their ability to choose jobs in lower paying professions. So I think that if anything changes over time, there's going to be a move to try to limit the volume of money that students borrow.
Okay, Jeff, what's happening in public schools given that states have taken such a big hit?
The public schools have actually not been as bad as people thought they might be, mainly because of the stimulus money. What is really of a big concern is that once the federal stimulus money aid to the states ends, what's going to happen to university budgets? And the feeling is that they're going to take a nosedive because most of the money that the states are going to put into education is probably going to go through K-12, and state legislatures know that universities could turn around and increase tuition rates to students in order to make up for losses in state appropriations.
Well, and they might look to California to see what their future looks like. Tuition at some California state schools is increasing by a third, and state support has dropped more than 20% over the last 2 years. We know they've had the huge budget crisis.
The bigger problem in California, I mean, you have to put that a little bit into perspective, is that the tuition rates are relatively cheap in California, so a 10%, 20% increase may sound like a lot, but it's on a much smaller base.
Can you give us an idea?
I mean, we're talking an increase of a couple $100s, where if you were having a 10 to 20% increase at a private university, you're talking, in some cases, you know, a couple $1,000s.
Well, hold on. You've got my attention now. How much? I mean, these are terrific schools in the California system. How much does it cost?
Most of them are under $10,000 a year in terms of tuition.
Wow.
You know, they're about half the cost of a private college. And yes, the UC system, the Cal State system in California are very good. And that's part of the problem right now is that everybody wants to go there and there's not enough room for all these students. Yeah. You can almost apply at any time in the past and get into a Cal State campus if you qualified. There are now about 15 Cal State campuses that have already closed admissions for next year. They are being overrun with students from the community colleges, from students who would have gone to privates but now want to go to publics, and they simply don't have enough room for them because the state has really cut appropriations. And as a result, they can't really charge students the real cost of education, which would be $20,000, $30,000 a year. And so they're basically closing out spots for students.
Well, Jeff, before we let you go, I just want to touch on for-profit colleges because they're small but growing. Many of them are these online schools like Phoenix University. They've become very popular. And we understand the Obama administration is cracking down on how much financial aid goes to them. The Education Department says federal aid to students at for-profit colleges last year jumped to $26 billion from $4.5 billion in 2000. Why is there concern that money's going there?
There's a lot of concern that for-profits are simply enrolling students in order to get their federal financial aid dollars. Most of the revenue, about almost 90% of the revenue that goes to for-profit colleges, comes from federal financial aid programs. So the concern is that the more students for-profits enroll, the more federal dollars they get. Many of these students then are either not graduating, graduating late, and then defaulting on their federal loans.
So there's some proposed rules that may disqualify for-profits from receiving federal aid if, for instance, their graduates have to spend more than 8% of their starting salaries on repaying student loans. But just since we've wandered into this territory, is there also going to be sort of more oversight of these for-profit schools to see what they actually teach and what kind of degrees are being given out?
I think there's a lot of questions about the oversight right now. I mean, they're accredited, just like nonprofit colleges are, but these accrediting agencies are regional. They're being run by people who essentially run the colleges and universities. So there's a lot of concern that they're guarding their own people. And so there is some question right now about whether there should be a federal regulator, kind of an independent regulator, to look at what colleges are doing.
Jeff Salingo, editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education, thanks so much.
It was great to be here.
Okay, quick look ahead tomorrow on Here and Now. Arizona's tough immigration law that requires local police to apprehend illegal immigrants has spawned copycat bills. We'll check in Utah and Pennsylvania. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, what is the big deal about the Rolling Stones' reissue of Exile on Main Street? Here and Now. With cheering veterans behind him, Connecticut's Attorney General Richard Blumenthal is attempting to save his nationally watched Senate candidacy from a potentially devastating blow, telling reporters at a news conference that he never intentionally sought to misrepresent his military service in Vietnam.
Now, on a few occasions, I have misspoken about my service, and I regret that, and I take full responsibility. But I will not allow... I will not allow anyone to take a few misplaced words and impugn my record of service to our country.
The press conference, which is just wrapping up, is in response to a New York Times article today that claims that Blumenthal said he was in Vietnam in combat when he wasn't. And they post this audio of Blumenthal giving a speech 2 years ago honoring vets.
We have learned something very important since the days that I served in Vietnam, and you exemplify it. Whatever we think about the war, whatever we call it, Afghanistan or Iraq, we owe our military men and women unconditional support.
Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News. Rick, this has been a pretty extraordinary day. There you have it. Blumenthal saying, I served in Vietnam, and has apparently said that on other occasions, but today saying he misspoke. Your thoughts on the press conference?
Yeah, I think it's really a page out of John McCain is my first thought. Remember when there was a story in the New York Times alleging an affair that he had, he decided to answer all the questions immediately and try to put it to rest. That said, I think this is likely to have legs, and it's not clear from his explanation how he would have misspoken in this particular manner. It seems like an odd misspeaking to speak to certain groups and say as clearly as he did, I served in Vietnam. The quotes are out there, and people are going to have to make their own judgment as to whether they believe his explanation for it. What makes this particularly peculiar is that he wasn't even consistent in misspeaking. I mean, there were different versions of the misspeaking in something that I think in most people's minds would be pretty clear.
Well, and we should just give some background. Blumenthal, for months, has been the leading contender to fill retiring Christopher Dodd's Senate seat. He has to go through a primary process, an appointment process by his party, but it was considered a sure bet that he'd get his party's nod. And then he's up against a Republican, Linda McMahon, who, by the way, is with the World Wrestling Organization, World Wrestling Entertainment. She has acknowledged that she gave this information to the New York Times that while Blumenthal was only in the Marine Reserves and carried out public service in Washington, D.C. and helped out with Toys for Tots, that he had on occasion said that he served in Vietnam. So first of all, your thoughts about the fact that the New York Times didn't acknowledge that they got this information from his potential Republican opponent.
Yeah, you know, that's pretty standard practice in the world of opposition research where candidates drop damaging information about their opponents. What's not as common is for one of the candidates to claim credit for it. So that to me seems to stand out. If the New York Times had the information and they were comfortable with reporting it, then the source of it, while it may be interesting, I don't think most media organizations would have outed. Often the sources give it anonymously. I don't know the conditions in this case. But what was interesting is Linda McMahon deciding to jump onto this as aggressively as she did and say, this, we're the reason this information got out there. It's important to note she's in a primary herself. Former Congressman Rob Simmons is also in that race. She's got more money than anyone else in the race. But clearly she wants to make sure if there's a political benefit that it accrues to her first and foremost.
Well, by the way, there's other news today. On the other side of the aisle, Republican Senator Mark Sauder announced that he's stepping down, alleging acknowledging that he had an affair. So Republicans took a hit today as well.
Yeah, and it's really extraordinary. I mean, it seems so similar to the stories we've heard over and over again of sex scandals and affairs with staff members. It sounds a lot like Eric Massa, the affair with a Democrat earlier this year. It's just another example of hypocrisy with a politician. In this case, Congressman Sauder, someone who has talked a lot about abstinence and conservative values, to be embroiled in something like this and to immediately step down, just another shocker.
Well, Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News, also host of ABCNews.com's Typeline newscast and author of the blog The Note. We'll continue to follow all of these stories and see how they reverberate out. Rick, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
And we're going to take a very quick break and come back and go to Uganda and concerns about the spread of AIDS in Africa. That's next, Here and Now. Recent reports, including one from the international humanitarian group Doctors Without Borders, conclude that the battle against AIDS in the developing world is at a critical tipping point, and it's not tipping in a good direction. Of 33 million people infected worldwide, fewer than 4 million are on treatment. For every 100 of people on treatment, 250 are newly infected. And the growth in funding has slowed as the numbers of infected people rise, forcing doctors to choose who to treat and leading family members to share their medication, which can result in resistant strains of the virus. Emmy McLean directs the Access to Essential Medicines campaign for Doctors Without Borders. Emmy, you were recently in Uganda. How's the situation there?
I have to say the situation is pretty dire in Uganda. Uganda is one of the countries that had really been, you know, at the forefront of PEPFAR's HIV/AIDS program, the U.S. government's bilateral HIV/AIDS effort. One of the key doctors in Uganda was sitting next to Laura Bush when the PEPFAR program was announced. And now organizations in Uganda, implementing agencies in Uganda, are being told they can't put new patients on treatment. Doctors who hadn't previously had to ration care are now being told that they have to ration care, only treating the absolute sickest patients first. Waiting lists are expanding, and some groups are saying that they can't engage in, you know, the same kind of prevention and testing activities that they had engaged in previously because they don't know what to do if people test positive. And patients are really the ones in the end who are suffering. They had been told that if they got tested and they found out they were HIV positive, that treatment would be available for them when they need it. And now that seems much less certain.
We understand one of the things that is happening is that big donors, including Britain and the U.S. and the Gates Foundation and NGOs, are shifting their focus to other killers like worms or malaria, water, because they're so much cheaper to combat. And the calculation they're doing, you know, they can save many more lives by, for instance, cleaning the water with less money than they can save with AIDS. Your response to that calculation?
It's an interesting calculation to make, and it's one that unfortunately we don't have the luxury to be able to make. AIDS is currently the leading cause of death of women of reproductive age. It's not possible then to say we're going to focus on maternal mortality, but we're not going to focus on HIV, and we're going to focus on the cheap interventions but not provide treatment for people. We know that in 6 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, HIV causes more than 50% of all deaths, including 80% of deaths in Botswana. It's the leading cause of death of children under the age of 5 in the 6 highest burden countries. We can't say we're going to step away from this and we're going to go focus on something else now. It's a commitment that the international community made, and it's a commitment that the international community needs to keep making.
Well, and of course, the difference with AIDS is that it's exponential, that it increases because of its, you know, ability to spread itself. Which brings the question, why hasn't more changed culturally? Back in 2004, we spoke with a Dr. Peter Mujeni here on the program about Uganda's huge success story, the ABC program, abstinence, be faithful, use condoms. The president of Uganda spoke about abstinence at every rally. NGOs and churches were all on board. You know, couples were encouraged to get tested before they got married. Uganda was seen as a model for other countries. what happened? I mean, yes, the funding has been cut, but why hasn't behavior changed enough to cut down on that increase in the new cases?
I mean, one thing that's important to note is that just behavior change is hard. It sounds sort of simple, but behavior change is very hard. We know we would have many more healthy, thin, very active people, you know, not smoking and always wearing sunblock if behavior change was not difficult. So that's true everywhere around the world. You know, those efforts need to continue. But one of the things that we do know is treatment is one of the most effective forms of prevention. We know that it reduces the viral load so that to decrease the transmissibility of the virus by over 90%. We know that there are biomedical interventions that can be used. We know that treatment is a really important component of that process. So you can't separate prevention and treatment and say, you know, we can focus on one but not the other. The availability of resources, the higher coverage of AIDS care and treatment has actually helped to destigmatize the disease and helped people come forward in a way that actually allows a real response on many different levels.
Donors now give about $10 billion a year. Estimates are that controlling the HIV/AIDS epidemic would cost about $27 billion a year, so it's way off. And the heartbreaking thing about this is that this happens at a time when the cost of the drugs has fallen. Drugs that once cost $12,000 a year fell to less than $100. I think the care of someone with HIV is something like $11,000 for their lifetime. So it's kind of heartbreaking that there's this disconnect, right? When things are more affordable, there's less money to spend on them.
I mean, that's the reality, and that's, I think, the struggle that we're all in right now is that, you know, a decade ago, the achievements that we've made thus far would have seemed, you know, impossible to imagine. We have 4 million people in developing countries who are now on treatment. There were really, you know, only essentially a few handful a decade ago, even though treatment was available in northern countries. The international community has really come together to scale up a meaningful response. But the needs remain tremendous. We can't be at a point where we're looking back at the past and saying, you know, that was a good period. People who were HIV positive during that period had access to treatment, and their family members, their children, their peers who now need treatment in 2011, 2012, and 2013, we are just not able or committed to providing the treatment for them at that time when it becomes necessary.
Well, but what do you say to Americans who are feeling pretty pulled at this point? We have a huge budget deficit, Haitians that need help, a lot of hands outstretched. Why should African HIV/AIDS go higher on the list?
You know, the reality is that there are people now who are going to have a much more difficult time finding treatment and treatment that is essential to stay alive. People are going to be getting on treatment later, even though we know and the international community has acknowledged and the scientific and clinical community has acknowledged that people need to be put on treatment earlier to increase their chance of survival, which also has financial ramifications, but most importantly, ramifications for the survival of individual patients. We don't want to be back in a situation like the situation that we were in a decade ago when patients were coming to clinics at the latest stage of AIDS, really at death's door, and their chances of survival were much lower. But the fear is that we're going to be moving backwards rather than forwards.
Emmy McLean is with Doctors Without Borders. They have a campaign for access to essential medicines. Emmy, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
And this note in the news, the White House says it wasn't informed about yesterday's court ruling granting President Obama's aunt, his father's half-sister, Zaituni Onyango, asylum. She'd been living as an illegal immigrant in the Boston area since 2004. When a court ordered her back to her native Kenya, she made the claim that to return to Kenya would expose her to violence. The court apparently agreed. And meanwhile, tomorrow in Here and Now, we'll take a look at anti-immigration laws across the country. Also later this week, a conversation with Bruce Feiler. He famously walked the Bible. How did that help him in his own bout with cancer? We're also going to take a look at the fine art of the audiobook. Do you have the stuff to be a narrator? That's later this week. Before we go today, the Rolling Stones put a fresh spin on a classic album, Exile on Main Street, Here and Now. Welcome back.
I hear you talk when I'm on the street. Your mouth don't move, but I can hear you.
The year was 1972, and kids around the world dropped the needle on the Rolling Stones' new album, Exile on Main Street. The song Rocks Off kicks off the sprawling double album, which is being reissued on CD and album today with 10 unreleased tracks. It's a big deal. In fact, our next guest says Exile, with its circus freak show cover art, is the single greatest rock and roll record of all time. Better than Sgt. Pepper or Dylan's Blonde on Blonde or anything by Joni Mitchell? Okay, we'll stick with rock. Billboard puts Exile at number 7 on its all-time best, so let's let Bill Janovitz make the case it should be number 1. That's what he wrote in his 2005 book. He's the leader of the band Buffalo Tom and joins us. Bill, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. And you wrote in your book in 2005, Exile on Main Street is the single greatest rock and roll record of all time. Do you stand by that today?
Well, yeah. I mean, the book is sort of the argument at the bar type of perspective on rock and roll, which is probably the best way to describe rock and roll or discuss rock and roll. So it was a bit of a hyperbole, but I pictured a guy pounding his hand on the bar and arguing against things like Sgt. Pepper's, just that very thing.
Or Pet Sounds, you know, which is the other one that people, as you say, hold up and wave. But what is it about Exile for you that makes it number one?
Well, I mean, those other records, as I say in the book, are sort of pop records and great orchestrations and really pushed rock and roll into a different direction. To me, Exile is the greatest rock and roll band in the world, getting back to what they really did best, and that is rock and roll. And it really kind of distills all of these important elements of rock and roll up until and including 1971, 1972. So you even got some Velvet Underground and Stooges influence in there, but it's really rock and roll.
You tell a funny story about the Christmas that you thought you were going to get it. What happened?
Well, you know, it was one of those things. I was, 12, 13 years old or something like that, and I shared a bedroom with my brother, and he's 2 years younger than me. Typical sibling rivalry, and he got into rock and roll as well. And one thing I really wanted that Christmas was Exile on Main Street. And somehow, when my parents were in the chaos of wrapping presents, I'm sure this is what happened. They ended up giving it to him instead. I had to pretty much bargain away all of my Led Zeppelin records for that one Stones record. And to this day, we both look at it as like a pretty good baseball trade where two sides got what they really wanted and needed.
Well, but you also look at your old, the album you still have, as like a baseball mitt, the thing that you can't, like an old pair of jeans, the thing you can't get rid of. What was it like to listen to it the first time?
Like you said, you drop the needle on Rocks Off, and it's an immediate song. But then the lyrics and the bridge of the song, and it really starts to instantly get murky. I mean, there's that really catchy riff, and it's rocking, and you're going, okay, great. And then all of a sudden they drag you into this weird sort of enigmatic swampiness, and there's voices coming in and out of everything, and there's just so many layers to the record.
Got it sweet like an angel, got it clean off good. Got it sweet like an angel, up upon the mile one. Well, she ain't no singer, she ain't no star, but she showed off the good, and she moves so fast.
Let's talk about another song, Sweet Black Angel. Was that about Angela Davis?
When they first wrote it, it was this sort of Jamaican folk tune. It was somewhere, I say it's sort of like a Jamaican strain called mento music, which is somewhere between calypso and reggae. And then I think Angela Davis was in the news, so he did. He wrote it as an homage to Angela Davis.
Professor at UCLA, charged with conspiracy to murder in 1970 in a racial unrest. She was eventually acquitted and became an icon. Tell us about another song that jumps out at you from Exile on Main Street.
I think there are some fantastic songs that are amongst some of my favorite songs that many people don't even know about. Things like Let It Loose, which is just, to me, it is so prototypical of what makes this record so great. It's that it's this gospel influence, and it's that Stax horns type of vibe, and it's Jagger sort of at his most passionate, just really singing it and almost bringing it against and having his game raised by having these gospel singers on the song as well. And I'm not even sure which came first, but it's a real sort of depths of the heart type song.
Move that woman on.
dressed up to do you harm.
Well, I want to talk about some of the new music. 10 new songs that are on the new release. Here's Plunder My Soul. Let's listen.
Can you believe it? I want no medicine. It's love game. I'm very scared of my lovers. I'm a bad loser. I'm a yacht off my pace.
I personally had never heard that one. And, you know, I was just driving down the road a couple weeks ago, and it came on like a classic rock station. I said, geez, I really had to pull over and say, what is this? Is this like a new Jagger solo? Because you could tell it's Jagger now singing. So it's a little weird, but it's got that, like, undeniable groove that you could find in Tumblin' Dice, which is sort of the holy grail of rock and roll grooves for bands that have tried to capture that. And then you hear the same kind of laid back behind the beat shuffle that on this Plundered My Soul, and it's just Mick Taylor added some new guitar riffs on it, which is sort of a homecoming for him, and then there's Mick singing on top of it, which is a little bit different, a little bit strange, but it's very interesting.
Well, you know, so Mick Jagger added vocals to Plunder My Soul, but other songs on the new release are from the old days that didn't get released at that time. Let's listen to one.
Walking down the street with a sad face, always complaining about the rat race. Nobody said the rat was free and easy.
You know, some would say, Bill, when songs don't get on a double album, there's a reason, you know. But in this case, are you just hungry to hear anything from the Stones? Plunder My Soul, as we said, has some new tracks on it, and you know, may feel fresher, but would you just want to hear anything that the Stones did?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think the completists like me certainly would, and Exile on Main Street is the ultimate artifact of a time and place, and that's what's the mythology of this record, is that it's made in Keith's basement in this Belle Epoque, I think, a mansion down on the French Riviera, and so they're in this basement. So there's this whole story. So anything that comes out of that now is just like it adds a little bit more pieces to the puzzle.
That's Bill Janovitz. His book on Exile on Main Street is 33 and a Third. It was part of a series examining classic albums. He's, of course, also with the band Buffalo Tom, explaining to us what exile means to him. And Bill, we're going to be hearing a lot about it. Mick Jagger, master at marketing, you've done Larry King, Morning Edition. We're talking about it now. What would you say to younger people coming up saying, ugh, will Mick Jagger please exit the stage? I'm so tired of my grandparents' music at this point.
Well, I don't think many people are saying that. You know, I look around and it looks like it's 1971 at the Middle East Club or wherever else. Everybody's kind of sort of got their beards and their vests and they're all rocking like Back to the Country and Woodstock and everything. So, you know, I think good music lasts. And they always said, hey, if the bluesmen could do it, they could do it.
Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you.